Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Mexican Americans are by far the largest Hispanic group in the United States. They have long made up the second largest minority in this country, and within a few decades will become the majority in California and Texas. This morning, in this hour of the program, we will consider the long-term influence that Mexican Americans will have on the character of our nation as we talk with Gregory Rodriguez. He is a senior fellow and director of the California Fellows Program at the New America Foundation. He's written widely on a number of issues, including national identity, race relations, immigration, and social and political trends for a number of publications, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Economist, the Washington Post, and the Los Angeles Times, where he is an op-ed columnist. He's the author of a recently published book, which is titled Mongrels, Bastards, Orphans, and Vagabonds, Mexican Immigration and the Future of Race in America. The book is published by Pantheon, and it's out now. If you're interested, you can seek it out in the bookstore. Also, of course, as we talk in this hour of the show, our guest, Gregory Rodriguez. Questions are welcome from people who are listening. And the thing that we ask of callers is that people are brief, just try to be as brief as they can be, just so that we can keep the program moving along and also get in as many different people as possible. But of course, your questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, that's the number, here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. So if you're here locally, use that number. But we do also have a toll-free line. And that one is good anywhere that you might be listening, on the air around Illinois and Indiana, over the internet in the United States. The number is 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Rodriguez, hello.
Hi, good morning.
Well, thanks for talking with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
How many Mexican Americans are there?
Oh, Lord, the number escapes me at the moment, but it's two-thirds of all Latinos in the United States who make up about 35 million total.
And I know here I was trying to find it, and I guess I couldn't find it, where that page where I got those little factoids there. Oh, here they are that I mentioned at the beginning. Another thing here I thought was really interesting. Cumulatively, over time, Mexicans have surpassed Germans to become the largest immigrant group in the history of the United States.
Absolutely. That's probably happened this year. It's a underreported fact. And when you ask about Mexican Americans, that's a little tricky too, because Americans meaning that they're naturalized or they're born here. So that total of two-thirds of all Hispanics, it's really those of Mexican origin. That includes both Mexican Americans and Mexicans.
And this is now, certainly we know that now the subject of illegal immigration, concerns people have about large numbers of individuals, undocumented people, and most of these people, I believe, are in fact from Mexico, being in the United States. That's an enormous issue now.
Absolutely.
But I guess having said that, one has to acknowledge that the movement of people from south to north across that border, maybe even before there was a border, this is not a new fact in America.
No, it really isn't. We tend to discover, whether for good or ill, Mexicans or Latinos or Hispanics, whatever, if you will, every 10 years or so. And we act like it's a new phenomenon. But as you suggest, the first Mexican-Americans sort of came into being in after the Mexican-American War in 1848, and that was by virtue of conquest of the Southwest, and then the annexation of Texas, and that was about 75 to 100,000 people. And then after that, there has been movement across that border. With the biggest movement then came in the early 20th century during the Mexican Revolution, and then that was unrivaled until the 90s, which was in another a very large wave. So yes, this has been a continuing process for 150 years.
Is there something going on at this particular point, though, that makes this such an intense issue?
Well, there's a variety of things. I think it's really twofold. One, I just got back from a nine-city tour, and, And obviously, the sentiment, it's technically an anti-illegal immigrant sentiment, but then it sort of blurs into an anti-Mexican sentiment. It does seem to be at a high pitch. Again, this is nothing new. It's rather cyclical. But at the other end of the spectrum, there is we are seeing the integration and the acceptance of Mexican Americans at different levels of society, such as a Mexican American presidential candidate, or the mayor of Los Angeles, or the speaker of the California Assembly. So at one end of the level, at the spectrum, Mexican Americans, long-term, latter generation, are becoming accepted as Americans more than they ever had before. And at the other end, there is this high-pitched rhetoric against illegal immigrants.
Do you think that this is something that is going to be resolved anytime soon? Obviously, this was something that was up for discussion in Congress. Members of Congress have one attitude, and that has to do with tough border security. The president, for some time now, has been proposing something to try to bring into the light, so to speak, people who have come here to work, who are undocumented for a variety of reasons. He's argued that that would be a good thing, there seems to be a lot of unresolved concern about, well, what exactly do you do with people who have broken the law to come here? I don't think that this issue probably is going to go anywhere this year, and I don't know to what extent we could expect that to be an important issue in next year's presidential race. But I wonder whether you think, in fact, we're going to come to any kind of resolution about this, particularly this question of how we deal with people who are here working, who want to be here, but who are undocumented. Do you think we're going to deal with that anytime soon?
Well, I share your pessimism, frankly, but I must step back and say Mexicans are also the largest group of legal immigrants in the United States. And secondly, the growth in the Latino population nationwide is no longer driven by migration. It hasn't been since the mid-90s. It's driven by procreation. It's driven by births. It's driven by the births of American citizens. So in a sense, the long-term projections of the growth of the Latino population is really presents a question not about immigration policy. It really presses us to think about integration policy. And that's really my concern. Over time, we spend so much time on the border, and we're not doing a terribly good job of it, that we forget that the broader issue really is how, it's the same issue as we've confronted as a nation from day one. How do we absorb, how do we integrate large groups of new peoples into our body politic?
And this is, so you're saying that we're having here, there are demographic facts on the ground that we have to acknowledge, and in fact that it's a trend that we're simply not going to turn back. So anybody who thinks that by building a higher wall between the United States and Mexico is going to do something about that demographic trend, they might as well save their effort, because it's not.
Absolutely. I mean, as early as 1994, here in California, the anti-illegal immigrant ballot initiative, Proposition 187, if you had stopped all immigration that day, legal and illegal, from Mexico, the projections that people of Mexican origin would still become majorities in the largest, most populous states of the Union, Texas and California, would still have been valid. Again, this is really a process of births of people who are already here. This is a demographic fact. And another, I think an important point is that as Congress really does not do anything, there does seem to be another trend that we're looking at, which is the bursting of the Mexican demographic bubble. That the number by 2011, it's been projected that the number of Mexicans who turn 18, who are not likely to be gainfully employed or be underemployed, will diminish each year for the next couple decades. So we're actually looking at the pool of potential migrants northward is shrinking every year. We, as you mentioned, it's a demographic reality, and it was a demographic impetus to move north, and it may be a demographic solution that'll stop sending so many people northward.
Yeah. The thing I guess that seems to concern, one of the things that seems to concern a lot of people who are concerned about the increase in numbers of people coming across the border, or perhaps in people who are settling here and having children and having that segment of the American population increase, there's all this talk about, well, what does that mean for America? What does it mean for American values? What does it mean for American politics? What does it mean for American culture? Do you think that there are, and this is something perhaps, at various points here, we may be talking some more about, out, but just to get that question in here up front, do you think that there are ways in which, globally speaking, Latinos, but specifically Mexican Americans, have already had that kind of significant impact on American culture, society, and politics?
Well, the distinction has been made. I mean, Mexicans tend to be congregated still in the Southwest, despite movements into places like Illinois, increasingly into the South. And they have been a large presence. So what we're seeing is an ethnic tipping point, really, that traditional groups, I mean, we've seen these sorts of tipping points before with Germans in certain counties and certain states in the Union where they become the largest ethnic group. And we see the nature of assimilation change, and people can have the privilege of maintaining some old world sensibility and some old world foods and styles longer than they did before. But at the same time, they're also absorbed into the United States, and they become over time there was a shift from an immigrant identity, from a Mexican immigrant identity, to an ethnic Mexican American identity. In many ways, as much as we talk about this, and it is unique, Mexican immigration is unique, but it is not so unique that we can't take some lessons and some analogies from the ethnic white European experiences that have that we so herald and we mythologize to some extent.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Gregory Rodriguez. He's director of the California Fellows Program and Irvine Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation. That's a nonpartisan public policy institute. He is also an op-ed columnist for the Los Angeles Times and is the author of a newly published book which looks at the history of Mexican immigration and the future of race in America. The title is Mongrels, Bastards, Orphans, and Vagabonds, and it's published by Pantheon. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-WILL, 333-9455 is the number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. One of the things that you look at the book, and I think is interesting, is how, first of all, the culture of Mexico, at least if you start your clock running from the time that Europeans arrived, has always been a kind of a blended culture, at least from the very beginnings. Europeans mixed with the indigenous population, and things went on from there. In what way did that help to shape the culture of Mexico and perhaps establish as a positive value this idea of mixing?
Well, Mexico is clearly a mestizo nation, a mixed nation. The historian Enrique Krause had said that mestizaje, the racial and cultural synthesis, is the essence of Mexicanness. And it's not that official Mexico in particular, or elite Mexico, has grappled with this any more successfully than anyone else. You go to Mexico today, it's a country that heralds its Indian ancestry, yet clearly favors whiteness in the status hierarchy. But I have argued that the mestizo, the rampant racial mixing on one hand, that collided with the rigid colonial Spanish racial order in New Colonial Mexico, created a sense of racial and cultural malleability, the movement of categories, the ability to change one's place and change even what one calls oneself, the ability to absorb and adapt and to improvise. I think we've seen that particularly as the mestizo comes north, a mixed person, and has been adapting to American culture since 1848. And so what I argue essentially is that vast numbers of mixed people coming into a racial order in America that has been premised on the notion, or the fantasy, if you will, of purity, helps and ultimately undermines and destroys the way we see race. We've seen race as a purely biological, consistent, permanent category. I believe that as the mixed people come north, they help break down this and say, hey, maybe race is more malleable, changeable than we thought.
Hmm. One of the things that you write about, I think, is interesting, is that at least early on in the Spanish administration, if you want to use that word, they tried to establish, or at least to create what almost seemed to be a kind of a system of castes, although I'm not sure how rigid this was, at least to identify people of different kinds of backgrounds and actually put names on all of them. Was that simply a matter of trying to catalog people, or did that have real implications as to how, you know, what one could do in life?
Well, I write the casta system, the caste system, as you mentioned, that came a bit later in the colonial period. The earlier racial system was the Spanish wanted to segregate the Spaniards from the Indians, and they were not to have mixed. The crown was interested in it because they felt that the white Spanish minority could be under siege by an indigenous majority in a new land, and the church wanted them separate because they wanted to protect the Indians from the bad influence of the Spaniards. But over time, economic necessity and Indians left their indigenous villages and went to the Spanish cities and created this mixture. Now, this began to undermine that two-part system. But what happened later is what you mentioned, this casta system, which it was an attempt to control, to make sense of all this mixture, and to hierarchicalize these mixtures, put names on them, and as if they all made sense, as if everyone would be continually identifiable as this and that sort of mixture. Let's have these people who are, let's have the child of an Indian and a mulatto. Let's name them this, and let's pretend they're going to dress differently and behave differently, and we treat them differently. But as you suggested, it was sort of a fantasy. It was a fantasy and an attempt by the Spanish elite in colonial Mexico to make some sense, a last-ditch effort to control mixture. What ended up happening simply was that the mixture was so rampant that it became foolhardy to think you could actually separate people on the basis of mixture.
And even as you said, though, I suppose you still do have to acknowledge that it was always the case that the more European you were, the higher you were in the social hierarchy.
Absolutely, and the casta system, which many have seen as a beautiful genre of colonial painting. I call it a perverse family portrait. When the portraits, many of them have 16 compartments, and they mention the race of the father, the race of the mother, and the race of the child, and it's hierarchicalized by the percentage of white Spanish blood that one has. So the top of the hierarchy is clearly a Spaniard. And in it is sort of a cautionary tale as well, that it was supposed to be teaching people who wanted to move up the ladder that they should be attempting to whiten themselves and marry up, if you will, than the other way around. But again, it really was sort of a fantasy, and it was about... It really told us a lot about the fear of racial mixing that the Spanish elite did have in colonial New Spain.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation, someone listening in the nearby community of Belgium. They're on our toll-free line, on line 4, right here. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I'd like to go back to a topic you just spoke on a few minutes ago. And you were talking about the various ethnic groups or nationalities that came into the United States. German, Irish, whatever groups you want to call. There's an interesting aspect about those groups, though, and that is, in the case of the Hispanic is very easy to go back home and come back across and go back home, back and forth, making it more of a temporal situation where the immigrants that came from Europe were pretty much stuck here because they couldn't get back home very easily. Doesn't that have an effect on what's going on here?
It has historically. It's a great question. Number one, there's two things. Europeans were not all stuck. About a third of Italian migrants are now thought to have returned home. But you're very right that what the illusion of going home for Mexicans. Now, look, Mexicans have had the lowest naturalization rate historically of any immigrant group, but what's instructive is when you ask who the second lowest is. The second lowest is Canadians. So it leads us to believe, yes, it has something to do with proximity of the homeland and the ability, or at least the illusion, that one's going back. And what happened for years is that legal Mexican immigrants, or those who had some documentation to come work, would come with the intention of working for a short time, making some money, and then go back home. And some of them did. Some of them went absolutely back home, got their money, had their experience, but many others stayed. And what happened is, until the sort of the backlash of the 90s, many were content to live as legal permanent residents within the United States without naturalizing. That was bad for them. That was bad for our body politic, to have so many people within our country that didn't dig in, that weren't participating in the system. Now, that has since changed since 1994, and then the campaign that against legal immigrants that sort of emerged after the anti-illegal immigrant initiative in the mid-90s. And what we saw was the largest rush to naturalization in United States history in the mid-90s. And that was really spearheaded by Mexicans. And we've seen a shift in Mexicans' view of citizenship. And so yes, it's a really good question. And really, this notion that one would return not only led people not to naturalize, it also led people not to join unions. It also led people to have a sense of impermanence. I've argued that was very unfair to their children, that the children then, who were de facto Americans by virtue of their birthplace, became sort of accidental Americans. Their parents hadn't really prepared them for their new civic identity. That, again, if there's a blessing to all this, to all the anti-immigrant sentiment, is that Mexican immigrants now know the value of United States citizenship.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. I think that there are two sort of commonplace ideas here that should at least be open to question. I'm not specifically putting this on the previous caller, but it's the kind of things that you're hearing now in the debate over illegal immigration. One is that for previous generations of immigrants, there was some kind of clean break, and that they somehow dumped all of their previous identities and identifications, and they became Americans. The other is that for Mexican Americans, there is a divided loyalty, and that somehow they don't completely become Americans, and that in this hyphenated category, they still retain an identification with the place that they came from that was somehow different from previous immigrants. And it seems to me that both of those things are really, we ought to be questioning them very carefully.
Well, it's an excellent point. Assimilation has always been, which has really become a four-letter word in America since the advent of multiculturalism the last 4 years. But whether you're for it or against it, assimilation happens. This is the most culturally, politically, militarily, economically, did I mention, most powerful country in the history of mankind. Mm-hmm. And somehow we're foolhardy to think that people who come here for it to take advantage of its riches or the opportunity that it may present are somehow they somehow escape the seductiveness of this culture. Now, having said that, assimilation has always been a hard, grueling, painful process. And as you mentioned, previous immigrants didn't just come off a boat and say, forget my old language, forget my old foods, forget my old networks and systems of meaning. It's always been this slow process of incorporating, and it's never been linear. As the way we imagine assimilation, we imagine it to be the linear process of ethnic self-obliteration. Mm-hmm. And that's not really what it ever was. It was more the maintenance of some things from the past and the acquiring of new things from your American identity. Secondly, the notion that the Mexican American identity is split is sort of is clearly it's clearly not true. If you look at polls, Mexican nationals clearly look at issues and the Iraq War, if you will, all sorts of global warming differently than a Mexican American. That we forget that Mexican Americans are from the United States, and they go to American schools, and they listen to American media, and they grew up more familiar with Bart Simpson than they do with mariachi culture.
We are at our midpoint here. Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, and then we go on to some other callers. Gregory Rodriguez. He is a senior fellow and director of the California Fellows Program of the New America Foundation. This is a nonpartisan public policy institute. He's also an op-ed columnist for the Los Angeles Times and has written on a number of issues, including things like assimilation and immigration and race relations and national identity. His work has appeared in New York Times, Wall Street Journal, The Economist, The Washington Post, as well as the LA Times. He's the author of a newly published book that looks at Mexican immigration and the future of race in America. That's the subtitle. The subtitle of his book is Mongrels, Bastards, Orphans, and Vagabonds. It's published by Pantheon. Questions welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. And in fact, we have a couple here. Next up is calling someone calling from Villa Grove, and this is line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of comments. One thing, I think that the recent attacks against the media calls illegal immigrants is just an attempt to divide the working class. I think it's a really great, brilliant way for them to divide working people in this country, because if the U.S. government didn't want 11 million people that would work for lower than minimum wage, we wouldn't have let them in our country to begin with. I mean, we're the most militarily powerful country in the world, and we could very easily control our borders if we wanted to. I also have one more comment, and I think that if we are going to build a fence anywhere, we should just build it around the White House, because I think that's where our biggest problems lie. I feel like this is one continent, one world. Everybody has a right to work and feed their family. And I think the only people that benefit from this is the capitalists.
Well,
that's all I have to say.
All right, Mr. Rodriguez, you can comment on that any way you like.
Thank you.
Sure. In this case, the White House was on the right side of history. And, maybe they were morally, at least, but not in effect. The George W. Bush wanted a form of immigration, comprehensive immigration reform, and he fought very hard for it and lost because of his own devalued political capital. So, in his defense, George W. Bush really did push for the legalization of 12 million undocumented migrants. And secondly, I'm not sure I'm as conspiratorial as the caller, but there was an element of truth to what she says, that in essence, Congress doesn't want to pass a guest worker program, because we already have one. We have a de facto guest worker program whereby millions of people can come and work and have no real rights. And they can be sent off anytime the employer likes. So, in essence, the millions of undocumented immigrants does serve some interests in our country, particularly business.
All right. Thank the caller. Let's talk again with someone here, line number two, here in Urbana, where we are. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
The Texas historian T.R. Fehrenbach describes the people of Mexico in the 19th century as subjects of their government rather than citizens. Would you say that is true today? And also, how would you say the process of going from a subject of a government, maybe, or to a citizen of the U.S. is being accomplished? I think you've covered that in context in earlier statements, but is there something more definitive you could say on that?
Number one, I interviewed Mr. Fehrenbach once. That was a very entertaining interview in Alamo Heights, Texas. But overall, I can't speak to the current state of Mexican politics or the status of its people. But I do know that Mexicans and Poles, but those in Mexico, tend to be very pessimistic about government. They tend to have been sort of beaten down by a very corrupt and mismanaged oligarchy that runs Mexico. There's a reason why so many people have come up north, and it isn't just the pure allure of our culture. It's also the terrible mismanagement of that country. And having said that, we look at polls of Mexican Americans, particularly let's say California, where about 85% of Latinos are of Mexican origin, and the best polls are from Public Policy Institute of California in San Francisco. They do polls of Californians every 6 months, and what they have found consistently for over a decade now is that Latinos, most again of Mexican origin, tend to have more faith in government at this point than do Anglo-Americans. So I think that his question is right on. I mean, does this pessimism in government translate into as the people come north? And the answer is absolutely not. The Pew Hispanic Center actually asked a really interesting, perhaps the most interesting question they've ever asked in a national survey, and that was about whether any individual person had a say in their fate in their destiny. And you look at people, foreign-born people tend to be more fatalistic, tend to be, or belief in grace, if you will. It's not a, just a negative, the sense that, you know, there is, that their destiny is chosen by some higher order. But those who are born here tend to think that they have agency. And you can see that the longer someone's here, the longer this American sort of can-do-ism seems to absorb them. And they have greater faith in their own agency and in decisions in their own future.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. I would like to have you talk a little bit more about the process of developing what we might call a Mexican-American identity. And I'm thinking about the fact that for example, it wasn't until sometime in the 20th century that the Census Bureau actually gave people the option of identifying themselves as Mexican. And certainly, politically speaking, Chicano as an identity is something that's relatively recent, I guess maybe since the 50s, or it may in fact be go further back before that. But to what extent did this development of a strong sense of Mexican-American as an identity, what that means, particularly, I guess, for the involvement of Mexican-Americans in politics?
Well, many historians pinpoint that the 30s and the 40s of the emergence of a strong Mexican-American identity, that the children of the large waves of immigrants who came in the teens during the Mexican Revolution, and then those who stayed after the repatriation during the Depression, many Mexicans were pushed back during the hard times. The identity of the U.S.-born ethnic Mexican really emerged in the 30s and 40s and was really given a shot in the arm by the experience in World War II of many Mexican-American soldiers. And it was a similar story we've heard before. They came back from war fighting for the United States and then demanded their rights as Mexican-Americans. But there isn't any real magic difference between a Mexican-American or other sort of hyphenated American, that it is this constant balancing of one's ethnic identity and one's civic or national identity. There isn't anything that particularly distinct in that of other Italian American or Irish American. The one thing that does make it distinct is the presence of constant newcomers. So if you are a Mexican American somewhere in central Illinois, and there's no other Mexicans around or Mexican nationals or recent immigrants, by and large, you're probably going to incorporate over time and be seen as ethnic Catholic American. However, we've seen now through studies that if that person in central Illinois suddenly, if their community receives large number of new immigrants, right, new Mexican immigrants, it sometimes calls into question the Americanness of that Mexican American. What happens is that Mexican Americans tend to be their Americanness is questioned by people who don't make distinctions between a recent person who's been here for 3 days and a Mexican American family's been here for 80 years. That's the one thing Mexican Americans do have to contend with because of the continuous nature of Mexican immigration. One of my favorite examples of the last year is that, in all its wisdom, New York Times wrote about our immigrant leaders in California. It mentioned Arnold Schwarzenegger, who was indeed an immigrant, and Antonio Villaraigosa, our mayor of Los Angeles. 2 days later, the New York Times wrote a little correction that said, Mr. Villaraigosa was born in the United States. We are perennial foreigners, even as long as we've been here.
Yeah. How in what ways has the need for labor shaped Americans' attitudes towards and it either receptiveness of or rejection of Mexican Americans?
Well, it shapes the essential relationship with Mexico in that we bring them in during good times and we push them out during bad times. And Mexicans, again, played into that, as I mentioned earlier, with their sense of impermanence, their sense that they were only coming for a short time. They played into the illusion that they were an easily gotten rid of labor source. You know, they were easily malleable. So it created this illusion that you could receive labor without having to actually incorporate laborers and their children. I think absolutely that the essential relationship between the two countries is based on the need, on the one hand, the need for labor on this end of this side of the border, and the need for Mexico to lose so many people to relieve its own social pressures. And that's what we finally almost got on September 10th, 2001. There's a famous meeting with Jose Castaneda, the former foreign minister of Mexico, and Colin Powell, the Secretary of State then for the U.S., in the White House had shaken hands, and it was essentially acknowledged for the first time the U.S. was going to acknowledge its need, and Mexico was going to acknowledge its need. Unfortunately, Osama bin Laden, among many other horrible things that he did, managed to destroy any sort of compromise with Mexico.
Yeah. Well, that points to the fact that I think in and amongst the arguments that people make for greater security along the border between the U.S. and Mexico is concern about homeland security. But one wonders just to what extent that's a convenient argument to make when, in fact, what it is you're really thinking about is something different. That's not to say that we don't have those concerns. We should have the same concerns with the border with Canada, but we don't talk about building a wall between the United States and Canada. We don't think about that border in the same way. So I guess one wonders just to what extent national security concerns really matter here, or whether that just we can use that, but what we're really thinking about is something else.
Well, if you look at the anti-immigrant and the advocacy groups over time, you'll find that they really adapt their arguments to the time. In the early 90s, it was all economic. There was the economic threat of immigrants. As the economy got better, then they got into carrying capacity environmentally, that these people are bad for our country. Recently, you had to laugh. You saw the study, perhaps, that illegal immigration erodes the environment near the border. So in any given day, you're going to find a new, as you're mentioning, sort of slightly serious and slightly opportunistic argument against immigration.
Hmm. Well, that's not you wouldn't argue that there wasn't at least something to some reasonable way you could talk about the idea of, well, what kind of population could the United States
absolutely
sustain?
Not. It's our right as a sovereign nation, and having myself talking to you from Koreatown in the central Los Angeles, where I'm one of the few people whose family's been here for generations, I know the cost. I see it every day. The cost of immigration is overburdened infrastructures, the schools and the health systems, and it's again the pressure on the body politic. In that, how do we absorb people? This is our constant challenge in our nation. And so, absolutely, I'm not an advocate of illegal immigration. It's simply that my concern is, if you can't solve it on a border process, and if you can't solve the problem on the border, the rest of us, it may make good AM radio. You know what I mean? That this haranguing about illegal immigration, but the rest of us have to think about the ultimate solution, which is incorporation of these people.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, I want to introduce again, is Gregory Rodriguez. He's a director of the California Fellows Program and senior fellow at the New America Foundation. If you're, by the way, interested in that and finding out more about it, you can go to their website, which is, newamerica.net, so you can see that what that's all about. He's written for a number of publications. He's a columnist, an op-ed columnist for the Los Angeles Times, but his work has also appeared in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Economist and the Washington Post, and he is the author of a recently published book that is about Mexican immigration and the future of race in America. The title of his book is Mongrels, Bastards, Orphans, and Vagabonds. It's published by Pantheon. Tell me about how it is you decided to put a title like that on the book. I'm sure did the publisher say to you, Gregory, do you really want to put that on the book?
It's a good question, and I'm embarrassed to say the answer, but quite the opposite. I wrote what is essentially to my own heart, it's a sober, thoughtful assessment of the Mexican past that helps us look into the American future, and my publisher wanted a provocative title, and it was an exchange. He respected the tone of the book, but he wanted a spicier title, and that's what I had to give him.
Well, then I suppose indeed
you have
to
sell books in the end.
Absolutely. No, I understand that. Obviously, if you don't sell the book, you're not going to get anybody to read it. You got to get people to pay attention to it. But I suppose that indeed that title does does say a lot about how in the past Mexican Americans, Mexican immigrants were regarded and how they still are.
Well, the point of the title is referring less to Mexican Americans and less to Mexicans as national identities and more to mestizos. The book is about immigration and how it affects race. And these are words that have been used to those people who are mixed and don't belong in rigid systems. And these mongrels was what the Secretary of State James Buchanan, the Polk Secretary, referred to Mexicans in 1848 when there was, what are we going to do with these people that we've somehow conquered and would have to absorb? And orphans really it's a reference to what the great late Mexican poet referred to Mexicans. He said these mixed people, we mixed people, are somehow that we've been orphaned from our two progenitors, from the Spanish side and the Indian side, and that he argued in his famous essay in the 1950s that this orphan people is always looking for their origins.
Hmm. And I guess again that takes me back to, you know, this idea that here in the United States we have from time to time had this idea about purity, particularly racial purity, but that you always have to acknowledge the fact that the United States was to an extent also a blended culture as well, because people came from all over the world to live here, and it's something that I think maybe we have conveniently forgotten.
We have, but there's one distinction. The melting pot and the idea of the melting pot was really exclusive to white ethnics. There was an acceptance of white ethnic mixing over time as opposed to racial mixing. And even the Israel Zangwill, the British Jewish playwright who popularized the notion of the melting pot with his 1909 play that Theodore Roosevelt was present at the opening night performance, even he, about 8 years later, after being scolded by Jewish leaders at the time, wrote that, well, when he talked about the melting pot, he didn't mean that it meant gamic, if you will, this physical interaction, that it was a spiritual miscegenation. So even our great herald of the melting pot backed off. After feeling pressured, that really okay, we're not fully comfortable with mixing races.
Yeah, it makes it a more sort of a symbolic kind of thing. It's a
exactly.
Metaphor. It doesn't really mean that, you know, people are, you know.
My general contention is yes, both nations, all nations, ultimately, if you look closely at them, if they embrace. This is about whether you embrace the notion of your mixture. And my argument is that Mexicans, in essence, I had dinner the other night with Walter Russell Mead, his new book, God and Gold and Britain and Britain and America, The Making of the Modern World, and he understood my book better than I did. He read it and said, well, what you're arguing is that Mexican-Americans help us be more American, that in essence, that they bring us a notion of the melting pot that expands our own version of the melting pot. And I think I was exactly correct.
Hmm. Talk a little bit about language, because this seems to be another one of these hot-button issues, as if indeed, again, looking at the experience of previous immigrants, that it somehow wasn't an issue before, and certainly in the past, it has been an issue.
Language is a big red herring. It's a really odd one. We have interest groups, in this case, large corporations, who want advertisers to believe that Latinos speak Spanish forever and ever and ever and ever, that they don't linguistically assimilate. I mean, it's a really odd. We probably never had that before, right? Large electronic media, clearly, in the early during the previous large waves of immigration. Now we have interest groups who want to make you believe that this is a permanently foreign, a permanently targetable and separate market, and they're the ones to get through to these people. But what census data shows, it's that linguistic assimilation for Mexicans, particularly those who arrive in the Midwest, is extraordinarily thorough. I'll give you an example. In 1990, two-thirds of Mexican-American children ages 5 to 18, this is census data, spoke only English. Now, I'm not saying this is good or bad. I'm saying it is, okay? And those who were bilingual clearly were bilingual, that the maintenance of some sort of Spanish, which happens closer you get to the border, does not preclude the learning of English. Now, during the 90s, with this vast wave of Mexican immigration and this huge boom in Spanish language media, one would have thought that this two-thirds would lower. At the 2000 census, 71% of Mexican-American children aged 5 to 18 spoke only English. So over time, we're seeing a really strong tendency toward English. And again, the Economist magazine projects that 50% of the globe will speak English relatively fluently by mid-century, and it seems a bit foolhardy to think that people within our own border will somehow avoid that fate as well.
Well, that's interesting because I guess I would think that a lot of people, their perception would be that there would be significant numbers of Latinos who feel that they want their children to still be able to have a functional knowledge of Spanish.
Immigrants always want that, and they do want that. If you poll, and I think this is the Washington Post or the Pew poll, you poll Latinos overall, 85% say exactly what you would think they'd say, right?
Mm-hmm.
That they would like their children to speak Spanish. But the next question is, do you think English is important for getting ahead in the society? And it's about the same. 87% say English. But what we're forgetting is the average age of a Mexican immigrant is not very high, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the maintenance of a foreign language within the United States requires a formal infrastructure of school. Look at what the Germans set up the most complete ethnic parallel infrastructure of any immigrant group in the history of the United States, right? There were schools in which there were papers, there were clubs of all types. And that allows you to maintain a foreign language within the United States over generations. Mexicans never created those things. You see what I mean? There's not even the infrastructure that would enable them to keep a high level of Spanish over time. What if they are bilingual, it tends to be sort of, you know, familial, colloquial, informal talk. But their education tends to, if they go up the ladder, it tends to be in English, and that becomes their professional, their primary language, if you will, their public language.
I'm interested, you touched on this notion, and I'm interested in what way the fact that now in the United States we have significant number of Latinos and people who do speak Spanish, and they have been identified as a population to which you can market, to
right.
which you can sell stuff. It's a great, you know, the Hispanic market in the United States seems to be quite significant and growing all the time, and people who have stuff to sell certainly know that. How important is that?
It's important on one level. What it does is the Hispanic market is really the foreign language. It's really the Spanish language market.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's part kahui. I mean, let me give you an example. I won't mention them, but a large book-selling chain moved into the San Gabriel Valley neighborhood, that's here in Southern California, a city of Pico Rivera, and it was a Hispanic city, whatever that means. So they put in a bookstore, and all the books were in Spanish. Suddenly, after 2 weeks opening, they realized these were Mexican-Americans who primarily read English, and they had to change their whole stock into English. This is the Latinos, even Mexican-Americans under themselves, are a vastly and wildly heterogeneous population. They're multilingual, they're multiracial, they're multi-class, they're multi-generational in that many of them may have come yesterday versus someone who came 30 years ago, as someone who came 5 generations ago. And to somehow assume that these people share a market culture is an absurdity. I mean, it's just like saying we don't say there's a white market. We say we disaggregate them into ages, sexes, lifestyles, sexual preferences, right? Regions.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems, we're still sort of trying to absorb the 35 million people into one simple clause. And that really only serves the purposes of marketers. So in a sense, it's nice that immigrants have access to access to goods. And to some extent, this large market does often hire people who can speak Spanish, however poorly in the second or third generation. So on one level, it creates an economic opportunity for some Mexican-Americans. On another, it doesn't. For instance, I was met in Chicago with a large Spanish language network. Fox Television is much more, they admitted this, is much more likely to hire Mexican-Americans, U.S.-born Mexican-Americans, than is Univision. Why? Because they tend to speak English better than Spanish. Their Spanish is not good enough to be on Univision. You see what I mean?
Mm.
So in essence, It's a little, it's a bit of smoke and mirrors happening. And the one thing, if it was ever nationally acknowledged that there was linguistic assimilation over the generations among Latinos, their stock would implode overnight.
We are coming down to the point here. We pretty much have to finish. I guess I'm interested in, again, coming back and touching on something we've already touched on, and that is somehow here in the near term, what are we going to do to address this reality that here in the United States we have, and I guess the number that I've heard, is something like 12 million people who are here who are undocumented, who have come to work. We rely on their labor, but they have no protection. They're a very exploited population. So how do we deal with these seemingly irreconcilable arguments that on the one hand, we ought to bring these people out in the open, make it possible for them to work legally, pay taxes, have some protection that we afford other workers? How do we balance that up against those people who continue to say, well, as far as they're concerned, the bottom line is that these people broke the law in coming here. So as unrealistic as it might be, people are still talking about taking a law enforcement approach to this kind of issue. And I mean, it just seems like this is an unresolvable kind of argument.
The one resolution, and I am not the right person to ask this question on migrant policy. I'm pessimistic, as are you. The one resolution is that the children of these people are Americans. And my idea is that this is really a time in which our country needs to start rallying around its shared civic ideals. That we've had 40 years of multiculturalism, and that's all very well and good. That we needed to learn our appreciation of pluralism. We needed to learn tolerance. We now know that one can celebrate Hanukkah and be fully American. But right now, given that 12% of our population is foreign born, we're getting near the historic highs of 1880 and 1990, which were 15%. That we now have to shift into an era in which we're talking about what it is we share. We need to integrate those immigrants who are eligible to integrate, and we need to start thinking about our nation as an absorptive power and do our part as native-born citizens to bring them in. And I do not deal with the immigration policy. My concern is that we have to start treating their children as Americans, because they are, and we have to start expecting of our new Americans to embrace what it is that made this country a great country, what it is that lured their parents here in the first place.
Our guest, Gregory Rodriguez, op-ed columnist for the LA Times. He's director of the California Fellows Program and is Irvine Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation. His book, Mongrels, Bastards, Orphans, and Vagabonds, Mexican Immigration and the Future of Race in America, is out now from Pantheon Books. Mr. Rodriguez, thanks very much.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you.